Hi, everybody. My name is Jack Bagby, and I am an alcoholic. And I want to thank Billy for asking me up here. This is so great. I had to have a reason to get out of that house. I get hunkered down in the snow. And so I had a nice trip up here. I really did. And I appreciate him, you asking me, Billy. My sobriety date is December 30th of 1996. And that just happened to be the day they put the cuffs on me for the last time. That's why I happened to be that day. So, it is by the grace of God, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, folks like you in rooms like this, that I'm alive and sober and here tonight. Absolutely. Our Grant Clancy talk about grace, and he said that grace is like the rain that falls on the unjust as well as the just. And I thought that was one of the most profound things that is a metaphor. And really, all I have to do is put the umbrella down. And that was the process of clearing away the obstruction and working these 12 beautiful steps. And I am sponsored. And I do sponsor others. My home group is the New River Valley Men's Group, closed meeting in Christiansburg. It is a non-restricted meeting. So if a woman wanted to come in, needed a meeting, there's no problem. You'd probably have a whole happy bunch of guys there, as a matter of fact. So, but it is a special purpose group, but not restrictive. And we invite anybody to come down at 7 o'clock. On Sunday nights in Christiansburg at the Christiansburg Presbyterian Church. Right, and so if you're ever in Christiansburg on Sunday night, stop in and see us. Like to have you. I said that my sobriety date was the day to put the cuffs on me. That is a fact. And, you know, every year that I'm in this fellowship, it becomes more profound to me what exactly happened on December the 29th. December the 29th, I had been drinking up to 2 o'clock that morning, and I believe my last drink was a Heineken. At 2 o'clock in the morning, I had to see my probation officer early in the morning in Richmond. U.S. probation. I was one of those feds. And I wanted, beyond anything, to be able to just be released. And I really, by all rights, I should have been. I could have posted some bail. They hadn't really violated me yet for probation violation. That was coming. I just wanted to get out. I wanted to get out so I could get a bottle, man. I parked in front of the U.S. probations in front of in Richmond, on Main Street in Richmond, and I had what was left of a bottle in there that was ready for me when I walked back out, because I fully expected to be released. And they wouldn't. I was in there first night was Richmond City Jail, and then they took me back to the courthouse jail, and I thought, oh, this is it, you know. And really, the only thing I was thinking about was just to get out so I could get to my car where the bottle was, or to get to a liquor store wherever they were going to release me. That's the only thing in my mind. And they did not. In fact, that was the beginning of a bit of a journey through the federal system and a whole bunch of different institutions before I finally got released. Wow, what a blessing. What a blessing. And it seems like every year it sends chills up my spine to have had such a direct intervention like that. But anyway, I'll get to that a little bit later. I was brought up in Southern Virginia, in Danville, and my dad was an alcoholic. And he died of alcoholism. He did get sober through the fellowship and the in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but he died 6 months later, and he did die of alcoholism. He was 61 years old when he got sober. And it was just too much abuse, and his organs were failing. He had a heart attack. And I was, at the time, I didn't know what a blessing that was, that he was able to find sobriety, even if it was just the last 6 months of his life. So, you know, most of his life and all of my life up to that point, I was being raised by an alcoholic father. My mom had some pretty severe mental problems. I like to laugh and say I grew up, it was sort of gone with the wind in a duplex. It was just out of control. You know, they always acted like they had a lot of money. We have very little. I was raised in a duplex, and boy, I'm telling you. And but you know what? Today I understand that my mom and my dad did the best they could. And in fact, when I got sober, I was set to work on my inventory to find out why I wasn't a particularly good son, and set aside what kind of upbringing I had. And that was okay, because I was so desperate to, at that time, to go ahead and do whatever y'all said to do. But lo and behold, I did come to know in my heart that they loved me, and they did the best they could with what they had. So I laid that to rest, and I did a great side amends with my dad. I was privileged to take care of my mom. The last 5 years of her life, I was the only one that was willing to take care of her. She died at 91, and she died actually in November of 06, about a month ago, so, 4 years ago. And what a privilege that was. It didn't seem like it at the time, because I didn't particularly like her, and we didn't get along. But nobody, she'd burn a lot of bridges and nobody was there for her. So I do understand now that they did love me, because I know how I love my children. And I abandoned my children emotionally. But I always had a sense of loving them profoundly. And I just could not be a good father until I got sober and I started to learn something about fatherhood. But anyway, my first drink was at 11 years old. And I was at a wedding for my cousin, and she was a few years older than me at the time, of course. I was just 11. And my aunt, and I had a cousin my age, and there was some other kids there my age, and my aunt thought it was a good idea to see. Well, thought it would be cute to give the kids a drink of champagne, you know, to see what they do. Exactly what I did. Except for maybe a teaspoon of whiskey and sugar, I don't remember. I don't ever remember that ease and comfort from any alcohol until that point. And that was a full glass of champagne, later to be two glasses. But I remember taking that glass of champagne, and I watched my peers, and they were sipping it, you know, like you do with a bubbly. And I took that glass, and I downed it like it was a Coca-Cola. And I could down a Coca-Cola pretty, about 2 or 3 seconds flat, you know, if I was really thirsty. And that's the way I drank that glass of champagne, partly to show off the grandiosity. Plus, you know, this is my first introduction to a social drink. I never sneaked anything out of, you know, that we didn't have in the house. My dad snuck drank, and mother wouldn't allow it in the house. So this is really the first drink I ever had. And I want to tell you, when I drank that first glass of champagne, I felt that ease and comfort that we all talk about, that warmth, and most particularly, I had relief from social anxiety, that feeling of being less than, not fitting in, everybody having the agenda to life except for me. I won't say a word about that. Well, first, let me tell you, I had that drink, and the rest of people, the rest of the kids that were there, they took their time. Some of them didn't like it, so I put the glass down, and some of them drank it, but nobody drank it like I did. And I remember going back to my aunt and asking for another one. I want another glass of champagne. As outrageous as that was, certainly nobody else was doing that, not even the adults. You know, some of them, I guess some of them might have been one of us, but I wasn't noticing. And by golly, I wore down. I wanted me that second glass of champagne, and I got it. And I remember a little bit of that ease and comfort disappearing with a little bit of unsteadiness. I didn't like that. I had reached that nice little point there after that first one. But I didn't know what was happening with me at that time. But I was relieved of all these feelings that I've been carrying around with me all my life. And a word about that is that I did have that feeling of not belonging and being different. That seesaw being greater than and less than, superior to, inferior to. And I remember that as a child. And that really was my first introduction to this incredible self-centeredness. Because in that insecurity, you know, who am I thinking about? I'm thinking about me. And because of the fear, I would go to any lengths to get what I wanted, what I thought I wanted, to fulfill some kind of need. I was a very needy child. And I didn't understand that until I got sober. Until the inventories, until I really understood the nature of my disease. I have a physical allergy and a mental obsession and a spiritual malady that drove the whole bus off a cliff. And this was the first inklings of my memory of that spiritual illness. All about me. And later on in high school, I drank a lot in high school. I got my license as early as I could. My dad finally had his license lifted after all the many years of the cops bringing back home, "Mr. Bagby, you go to bed now. You'll feel better tomorrow." Well, they finally start taking his license. And they took his license. They revoked his license. My freshman year in high school, I had just gotten my license. So I had the car. I'd take my dad to work. Then I'd go to high school. And I remember I was the only freshman at GW High School that had a car. And 1960, as far as 15 years old, you get a driver's license in Virginia, 14 for learners. And so here I was driving up in this 3 or 4 year old Rocket 88, you know, after dropping my dad off as a freshman in high school. Yeah. But it was another duplicity, and that grandiosity and that showing off. While on the inside, I knew why I had that car, and I knew that you knew why I had that car. So inside was the shame and the guilt that I bore from my dad's alcoholism and from my personality, along with that outside appearance of being pretty cool. So there was that cognitive dissonance. And that's the last psychobabble I'll say tonight. Please, somebody slap me if I do it again. But that was what we call cognitive dissonance. And that drove my drinking, too. It got to be very comfortable for me to carry feelings that I did not display on the outside. I was dishonest. Dishonesty. And drank through high school, shot pool, took my friends out who were underage, because I had the car. I knew how to use guilt and shame against my parents, too. Here I was driving my dad back to where I had to suffer his alcoholism. So I knew how to twist that to get what I wanted. Dishonest, self-seeking motives at that age. And I got very good at it. And so I was pretty well set up with my disease at a very early age. Now, I finally got out of high school. I did well in school because I wanted to look good. Had absolutely nothing to do with being ambitious or achieving something in the normal way. It was to get attention off of me so I could over here do what I wanted to do, but look good over here. So, there again, all this dishonesty. I got into a military school here in not too far away, and I made good grades there too, despite my rat ear. And but I learned how. I'll tell you what, VMI is one place that'll teach you two things. It's school good for two things: to become an officer and a gentleman. If I say gentleman, and a criminal. Good training ground, because I broke every rule there, and I made it through into my first class here within months of graduating with a commission in the Air Force and a degree in engineering. I had gotten so bold that I was smoking the organic matter over Washington Lee in a frat house, and other cadets were there, and they turned me in as a first classman. I was getting ready to go to flight school, and of course they kicked my butt out post haste, and they asked me at the committee meeting, says, did I actually do this? And they didn't have any real evidence except other people thought we were doing it. And I was so afraid of getting drummed out of that school for being, you know, it wasn't because I was an honest person, but I knew the consequences for not telling the truth, and I thought they had the goods on me. And so I said, yeah, I did that. And so the superintendent kicked me out for conduct on becoming a cadet. Well, that was the beginning of my living underground. I had met my first wife, and we had my first boy, John. And I did get drafted. That was a consequence in 1967. I was the first cadet to be thrown out. Me and two other guys for smoking the organic material or using any kind of drugs. And I used to think that was cool. Of course, inside, I was dying with shame and guilt. On the outside, I was going to become a hippie. Well, of course, I got drafted right away and got in the Air Force, and I had a young wife, and a year later we had a child. That marriage did not last. When I got out, I went back to University of Maryland to get my degree, and I did. But at University of Maryland, I found I could make a lot of money selling that organic material. So I went ahead and finished my degree, but I wasn't living like a poor veteran on GI benefits, which I was. I was living on GI Bill. I didn't have any money. My family didn't have money. And my wife was working, but I found I could make a whole lot of money. So I graduated, and then I was off on about a 10-year career in that. And underneath all this, during all this time, was an ever-progressing importance of alcohol in my life. Even though I was doing other substances, and I will say that the other substances, even though I got addicted to them later on, very much addicted. I didn't think I'd live without them. But it was only a part of my alcoholic insanity, my unmanageability. Because I gave them up. I could no longer, many years later, I gave them all up because I couldn't afford the good stuff. Besides that, I had my old ease and comfort. So I know I wasn't powerless over those things. And I remember when I first came to these reasons, I used to introduce myself as an alcoholic and an addict because I thought I was so daggone special. I now know what that's about. And this this last white chip I picked up in 1996, I knew exactly what I was. I was an alcoholic of a hopeless variety, beyond all human aid. And I was doomed. But I understand, I'm able to now, after working the steps under good sponsorship, to know exactly what I am. And I sort of knew already, you know, because drinking was always there. It got so bad that my liver was failing, and I was going to jail a lot. My second family had left me, too, along with the first, my second wife. I had two children with her. All my friends were gone. All my money was gone. This was many years later. A lot of in-between stuff. It's a pretty run-of-the-mill horror story that most of us know a different version of in our own lives, I guess. And, there was always that steady progression. I learned what it was like to live underground, off the radar. Didn't have anything in my name. And to have the feeling of financial security, and that I was a self-made man. You know, no thought of the fact I was indulging in criminal behavior. You know, this is just something for a lark, and we're just a bunch of hippies having a good time making a lot of money. In a sense, that not all that is untrue. I can't say that some of it wasn't fun, but it was all self-centered fun. Everything else took the back seat. My first wife took the back seat. My second wife took the back seat. My first child, my boy John, took the back seat. And Emily, my daughter, my second wife, and Matt, they all took a back seat to my will. After all, I know what's best for them, too, right? If everybody did everything my way, everybody would be cool, right? Well, of course, I never used my degree. During that time, too, I learned that I could make some money playing music. I played music all my life, and I did take that seriously, and I was very disciplined. And so I played music professionally, which, of course, I'm self-employed, working at night. And I think I'm doing something because I got to be pretty good. I worked very hard. And I played with some very good musicians, and so it was all the justification in the world. But gosh, what a dream life for an alcoholic, you know, until the nightmare started. Career was interrupted by my incompetence, my drunkenness, and my failure to present myself as a sober person with the right people in the music business at the right time. They knew as soon as they sat me down at the table to talk some serious stuff, they didn't know how drunk I was while I was playing when they heard me. I could play in blackouts. I have no memory of a lot of gigs I did. None. They said I played all right. Now, that's scary. That is scary. So that was another one that went by the wayside, opportunities. Because when I sat down and talked with somebody, I'm sure I could look at the look on their faces. This guy's a drunk. He's reeking. You know, this is the time of the day where I shouldn't be reeking. You know, it was the time of the day where if I just stayed sober, they thought maybe, well, he'd just drink at night when I play a little bit. Everybody sort of did that, you know, I thought. But a lot of people knew I was a drunk before I did. I want to tell you a little bit of what it was like with my children. I can remember several occasions that I must have put a million miles on my car under the influence. A lot of that was with my children in the car. I thought I was pretty slick. For years, after I really pretty much laid the beer away, I really liked vodka. Big surprise, sorry. I used to carry a little cooler around with a six-pack of little bottles, they were glass back then, but and they were soda, except for one. And it looked just like the rest of them. And, of course, that was full of vodka. And I put a little notch in the plastic cap right there. So when I reached in the cooler, I got a tissue around. There it is. And I could pour some real soda. I mean, the console, I was just, this is how grandiose I was. And so I was above it all. If anybody's going to get caught, it would be the other guy. He was also slick. I pour a drink, and then I say, oh, I ran out of bottle. Oh, let me get this one right here off and finish it up. You know, so I was just trying to cover up with anybody that happened to be in the car, is that they couldn't smell it on me. You know, I went drama. I'm serious, man. This is serious acting. To the kind of dishonesty that blows me away when I speak now. But in the big book, there's not one mention of the word denial. And I heard Tom Eye a few years ago talk about this. Now, I think that word is maybe in a couple of stories in the back, but in the first 164, the word denial is not used. Well, Bill, Bob, and the guys had a pretty ingenious way of describing denial. Well, denial for us, pretty well. In two words, illusion and delusion. I'm going to read the definition of illusion first. This is out of the Webster, so no opinion here. I try to bring books to keep my opinion out of it. Illusion, a false idea or conception, an unreal or misleading appearance or image. Many illusions I had to smash to get sober. Delusion, deluding or being deluded. A false belief, specifically one that persists psychotically. So, if I believe a delusion, then I become self-deluded, like unto being psychotic. A false belief. In other words, I buy the illusion, take it in, and firmly entrenched in it, and I become self-deluded. And the book tells me I suffer from 100 forms of fear, self-pity, self-delusion, self-seeking. And gosh, was that the truth. Well, I'll tell you what, I got into so much trouble. I will tell you this one time, I was doing this little trick with the bottles in the car. My daughter and a little friend of hers, she must have been about 9 years old. They were thirsty. They reached in that cooler, and I didn't realize it, and her friend had picked out the bottle. They had the notch on it. Of course, didn't have any idea what was in it. And she took a swig and choked and spewed it out all over the back of the seat of pure vodka. And she was okay. I don't think she swallowed any of it. But I turned around, I looked at my daughter, who was sitting right next to her in the back seat. And I'll never forget this look that my daughter gave me. And it was that my daddy doesn't love me anymore. She wasn't angry. She just had this pitiful look that somebody had just informed her that her dad didn't love her anymore. And on a level, that was devastating to me, but I was too self-deluded. And I was too good at covering up emotion and feelings immediately. And it had much more impact on me later on when I got sober, because I remember that incident very well. I remember that look on her face. And another time when she was going to be confirmed in the church, and I had progressed to the next stage of alcoholism. I think I'd already passed the jumping off point, or had passed over into powerlessness. I hadn't gotten to the jumping off point. I had passed into the realm of powerlessness as a late stage alcoholic. she was getting confirmed, and I just had to stay sober that morning. I was a morning drinker by then, and living with my girlfriend after Glory took my younger two kids and left me a couple of years before. I just had to stay away from a drink that morning. I had bought a Bible for her, and that morning I tried to put an inscription in the Bible, and my hand was shaking so hard that it's practically illegible. She has that Bible still today. I asked her, I said, if you want to give that to somebody, it would make me feel better. But I have to still take a peek at it every now and then just to get a sense of gratitude for what my life is like today. But anyway, I showed up. I had to have a couple of drinks. I could not maintain with a suit on that morning in the church. I was afraid. I really was afraid. I was starting to see things, and it was particularly bad because I went about the first 2 hours of the day without drinking, and I was just in terrible shape. So I'd take one drink, and by the time I got there, I'd had two or three. I wasn't falling over drunk, but you sure smell me. All dressed up there with other parents of other children to watch my daughter get confirmed in the church. Well, once again, I got that look from my daughter. As if Daddy doesn't love me anymore. And this time, there was a little bit of disgust, a little bit of anger in her face. It's amazing I can remember it that perfectly, like it was yesterday, and yet it was 20 years ago, 18 years ago. I could not drink. I passed over into that realm of powerlessness, and I was really beyond all human aid at that point. Well, it was another 3 or 4 years before I got sober after that. My girlfriend kicked me out of the house, by the way. I was on house arrest at that time when I was living with her. I'd been sentenced by the feds for a federal DUI, and within a month after that confirmation, I with my ankle bracelet on and everything, she kicked me out of the house. I was on house arrest and no house to be arrested in. So, God, what a pickle that was. And so what do I do? Treatment! I go to treatment. I got 30 days, got a place to live. And by that time, I'd arranged to come back to Virginia to live with the next best place when you're homeless. Moms! At 51 years old. And I stayed sober for 6 months that time. Doing AA, had a sponsor, did not use him. This old guy named Elvis. And he had a heart attack, and he really couldn't sponsor anybody. And I didn't get another sponsor, and he later recovered. He did well, but at that time he was his first heart attack, and I did not see my. I thought, I'm sorry for Elvis, but wow, he taught me I don't have to do the steps. We'll do them when he gets better. And 6 months, I got involved with this woman. I was so emotionally unstable and so insecure and so much fear about my masculinity and all, a million fears. I could not, and I had to manage the relationship, by the way. And I drank within days after first going out with her. And once again, sneaking it, and I don't know who I was fooling. I was going to meetings drinking. About a year after that, my drinking had progressed all the way back very quickly to where it was when I had quit 6 months before going to treatment. And oh gosh, it got worse so much faster. And I was charged with two felonies and two misdemeanors while on probation. And I'd gotten off the ankle bracelet. They allowed me to go to treatment and move down to Richmond, U.S. Probations from Maryland. But I violated. And that's when they took me to U.S. Probations in Richmond. I was charged with felony kidnapping, assault, several capias, and it was all within a year after I picked up that first drink again. That first drink always came year after year after year. I go to treatment, maybe have a week or two sobriety, a month or two sobriety. Always my car would wander into a liquor store. It was just a miniature, right? By the end of the day, I'd gone through a half pint, and then all a pint usually. By the end of the day, before the liquor store closed, I had me a good fit to get me through the night. And it all started with one miniature. Every single time. I don't know what it is with miniatures with me, but I feel like they're so innocent. You know, and just a state of delusion. And powerlessness. And that was the beginning. Beginning of the end of my nightmare. I had a distended liver. One time in treatment, they told me if I drank for another year, I would die of esophageal hemorrhaging. I had esophageal varices from my liver going bad. I don't know how much I got now today, but it's enough to function. So, they told me if I drank another year, I'd be dead. And I drank for another 6 years. And this is before I come back to Virginia from Maryland. And my thinking was, well, they must be talking about the other guy. He's got a year to live. And I was thoroughly convinced it was the other guy. Oh, not me. You know, I always got away with that. You know, I'll cut back. My liver will get a little better. You know, I'll cut back. Just totally in full flight from reality. And so when I went to Richmond City Jail, had a rude awakening. First of all, I was not going to get out. That was very rude. And my lady got transferred to Petersburg Federal Prison, which is not a bad joint, by the way. Still thinking I would get out and know exactly what I would do when I did. I mean, I got to give me a bottle. You know, I'll deal with the rest of it, but first thing, I got to give me something to drink. Went on for months like that. I finally wound up, after another few jails, the federal marshals will give me a grand tour back up to the judge in Baltimore, Maryland, to stand before him for probation violation, and wound up in Baltimore City Detention Center, which is the closest place to hell I can think of. Oh, God, it was horrible. I made the Richmond City Jail seem like a Holiday Inn, for real. And I stayed there for a good long time. Now, a series of events. Which cell you get put in is random. It's the first open bunk at the time my butt shows up there. And they put me in P block, which is a no-bail block, because I was probation violation. I had no bail until you see a judge. So I was in there with drive-by shooters, major heroin dealers, and homicide, you know, people who committed homicide, and murderers, and just, you know, most all of which were done under the influence. And I got to know some of these guys in sobriety, in abstinence, inside. And God, I couldn't tell the difference between them and maybe the people I meet on the street. All these horrible things they had done under the influence and of something. And but anyway, I was put in a cell, and it was the only cell. And I paid real close attention in the coming weeks. I would check out other people's cells if we were, you know, getting let out to do one thing or another. And everybody had this horrible graffiti in their cells, like graphic, good art, good, excellent artwork, incredible artwork, but just gruesome. And I won't even describe it. It's really odd. But in my cell, there was a serenity prayer. There were prayers that come from our recovery literature. There were Psalms and the 23rd Psalm. all etched with something sharp, which we're not even supposed to have in there. So evidently this guy took his shiv and carved all this stuff. No graffiti. And mind you, this is all random, right? Wow. And about this time was the time I was starting to pray to God that He helped me. It wasn't because I was in that cell, but I sure am glad I had the serenity praying all these wonderful things. And I said, wow, there is something going on here. But the motivation for asking God to help me, I don't know where that came from. Of course I do. And instead of wanting to get out so I could drink again, over a short period of time, I had this wonderful sense that it was going to be alright and that I did not have to drink again. And I already had exposure to AA, I had already met you folks. I knew where people go to get sober. Well, immediately after that, I was taken to a jail in the Eastern Shore, Maryland, one of the county jails where they had AA. They did not in Baltimore. And the guy that carried the meeting behind the walls gave me his big book because he didn't want me to wait for another week to bring me one. And I proceeded to read that book from cover to cover, mostly the 164 pages, over and over and over again, instead of playing spades or hearts or watching TV and stuff that people do in these medium security jails. And gosh, I had this wonderful feeling that it was going to be all right. And how I got out after another five or six jails to go through before I finally got down to Saluda. By the way, I never forgot that guy who gave me his book. I never forgot how those meetings, what they meant to me. By golly, if they hadn't showed up one week, I think I would have just fell apart. And they did. Every week I was in that particular facility. They were there every week. Never forgot that. And of course, I carry the message behind the walls. I have for the last 10, 12 years. I think I had 2 years sobriety when I started. And I now carry the meeting into Dublin Jail, New River Valley Jail. Never forgot that. Tom I says that we generally gravitate to the beginning where we had that transformation, that first transformation, that first surrender. And for me, it was inside the walls. And I was homeless, so when I got out, and I went to a campground in Williamsburg. I did not know it, but the owner of this campground was a person in our society with 9 years sober at the time. I did not know this. I was homeless. I did have an old beat up Mercury, 78 Mercury Cougar. My drunk car. I love that car. Everybody get out of my way. It's all beat up. And I say, God, this guy don't care. I'm going to get out of his way. But I had that Cougar, and I had an old StarCraft pop top trailer. It was all beat up, canvas torn. It was an old one too, didn't have a bathroom or any of that stuff, you know, barely had a mattress in there. And I found this campground, and Jerry told me, Jerry didn't tell me to get in service work, he told me to get a job. He says, it's $12 a night, every night. You don't have your rent for the day. You're out of here. No exception. And I'd say, I'm going to have a job pretty soon. Can I get a little behind and get back with you? No dice. You know, he didn't tell me to get service work. He didn't tell me to go to meet. He told me to get a job. You don't hear that much anymore, do you? And he knew I was going to meetings. I was going to meetings every day. I had a sponsor by then. And Jerry was wonderful. We became great friends. I lived on that campground for 5 years. I did graduate to a 26-foot trailer that he owned that I rented from him. And I was right down the street from Williamsburg, which is where I eventually went to work. It was a treatment center, Williamsburg Place. And story about Jerry real quick. Jerry, after 5 years of living there, I was getting ready to move out. Jerry had a back operation. And he started with the painkillers, an opiate. And within a year, he was dead. Within 2 months after this operation, he was already lying about his pills, saying a prostitute. He was having prostitutes over his house by then. He wasn't married, but he had his children in the house with him. They helped him take care of the campground. He was lying about his pain pills, getting more prescriptions, doc shopping. Finally, he picked up the vodka. I saw him come out of the bathroom of the campground. When there, he was in the stall. He was reeking of vodka, and he was just slipping something in his back pocket when he came out. And I cannot tell you the sadness of this man who had given me my first chance, and somebody who had offered me my first discipline, which I desperately needed. I watched him. Of course, this wasn't a slip. He went back out. He got drunk. He died. He died in his easy chair in his house. His oldest child found him with a bottle of vodka spilled over on the floor. And he was must have had a stroke or a heart attack. They don't know. I never found out. But I remember going to his funeral, and it was just the saddest thing. Powerful message. Powerful message to me. This man had 14 years at this time. I had 14. At the end of this month, I think about Jerry a lot. He had become unsponsored. He was managing his own life again. And he had this back operation. Perfect setup. Perfect setup. I'll never forget that. Worked at this treatment center. Working the ninth step, making restitution. My golly, I couldn't open a bank account. They wouldn't even take my money because I'd written so many bad checks. Within the first 6 years of my sobriety, I worked very diligently to make restitution. And little bits at a time, because I had to wait tables. That's the only job I could get, being having a criminal record. 51 years old, with a degree in mechanical engineering, and I'm waiting tables at 51 years old. Gotta love it. And, wow, what a trip that was. I got to be pretty good. I was terrible in the beginning, but I was able to make more and more restitution as the years went by. Got caught up on my child support, reestablished my relationship with my younger two children. My oldest boy in 1994 told me he didn't want to see me again. And he didn't for the next 11 years. I was 9 years sober before we reconnected. And that was only, 4 or 5 years ago. I found out I had a granddaughter. Now I have two. Go out to visit him now. He actually lets me take my granddaughters into San Francisco shopping by myself, just being them. Wow. 1994, he didn't want anything to do with me. I didn't want anything to do with me either. I was privileged to work at this treatment center for 5 years. I was a little bit of conflict with the staff, very argumentative person, because of course I had done this. Although the psychiatrists and the therapists were wonderful, I was a counselor, and this is a job. I had to do what I had to do. So I do some process groups and facilitate and give them self-knowledge. I did share my experience with them on a regular basis. Every day I talked to 1 or 5, 10 of the patients. And I always say, I identify with something, where they're at, and I would tell them what my experience was. And it was no question to them that I was a hopeless alcoholic. And at that time I was a recovered alcoholic. And so God blessed me with that job. I know that today. And of course, I never won any arguments there. I didn't have a master's degree yet, but I was okay. That was okay. They were very patient with me, and I was very patient with the patients. So it all worked out. I will say one thing. Recently, I got a new sponsor about 8 years ago when I was getting spiritually sick, and then I'll finish up here. And I want to tell you the difference it made. My first sponsor was perfect for me, a very spiritual man. We worked the steps as he had me work them. This time, though, after about 7 years ago, I found Bob, or he found me. I don't know how that happened. Boy, I'm so grateful to have him in my life today. We took the steps and worked them. I don't even know what that is. We took the steps. We followed directions and internalized it and practiced it in every field of my life. Every chance I get. And I remember this. This is what he called the first purpose. Forward to the first edition. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered. Is the main purpose of this book. And Bob, I've got this highlighted in red. Bob and I talked about this for a while, and he says, "Is there any reason why you don't precisely want to do what they precisely did?" No, I don't think so. So we followed the directions: praying when it said to pray, writing when it said to write, and doing what it said to do. Bingo! What's so difficult about that? Well, of course, it's very difficult for me to get that honest, for heaven's sakes, but I did as best that I could anyway. And worked and took the steps over again at a time I was getting so spiritually ill. Right after I finished that working at that treatment center, I was getting very ill spiritually. I wasn't sponsoring anybody. I was on 24/7 with a beeper at that time. I had had it with addicts and alcoholics. I want to tell you something. As soon as I got home, sponsorship wasn't even in the cards for me at all. When I left that parking lot every day from that treatment center, I had it with them. All of them, you know. I wasn't about to sponsor anybody. I did my meetings and I did my job. And let me tell you what happened to me. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. Gosh. We couldn't make a living. Well, I was making a living, but I didn't feel like I was. So for all practical purposes, I wasn't, right? I felt like I wasn't. I had terrible fear of financial insecurity. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. This was called the bedevilments. Now, in those bedevilments, alcohol is not mentioned, right? Nowhere in there. Alcohol is not mentioned. This is where I was when I found my last sponsor. And I was getting very sick. I don't know how close I was to the next, drink, to the first drink. But once again, I was intervened on by a loving God that I've come to know in this wonderful fellowship. And, gosh, I could tell you so much more what it was like, what it's like now. I have healthy, not as good a relationship with my kids as I was like, but, I've never had enough of anything. So, I'm so grateful for what I have with them. And I feel useful today, carrying the message behind the walls. I do sponsor others out of the book. I sponsor the way I'm sponsored. And God, what a privilege that is, intensive work with another alcoholic. And I see why they say it ensures our... Nothing can so much ensure our sobriety as intensive work with another alcoholic. And I could get into a gratitude list and take another hour, but I'm not going to do that. Billy, thanks for having me up here. I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much.